Episode 11 of the Torque Factor podcast is here, and I'm your host, Scott Brown. This is a place where we discuss all things moving the automotive service industry forward, focusing on expanding knowledge and awareness around tools, equipment, education, and industry trends. This episode's featured guest is Joe Register, who is the Vice President of Emerging Technologies at the Auto Care Association. Joe is here to shed some light on the recent ballot initiative in Massachusetts, which passed with extreme margins, extending the right to repair framework to address new technologies around wireless communications and more. Now, I've had the pleasure of working with Joe over the past year and a half, and I felt it was important to bring some visibility into what he and the teams around him have been working on. And more importantly, providing service professionals with some perspective into what's happening with the constantly evolving technologies being deployed on today's and tomorrow's automobiles and the impact they will have on service. VehicleServicePros.com is a trusted online resource for vehicle service and repair information, fleet maintenance management, and the latest products for servicing America's fleet of vehicles. It's the official website of Professional Tool and Equipment News, Fleet Maintenance, and Professional Distributor Magazines. VehicleServicePros.com is on the pulse of the industry, sharing new technology, the latest product information, and market trends to keep our readers in the know-how. Okay, that brings us to our recall segment. Recall 20-Victor-701 involves General Motors and the Chevrolet Bolt. That's a Bolt with a B as in Bravo. Potentially just under 51,000 vehicles built from 2017 to 2019 have a condition specific to the battery cells produced at the LG Chem's Ochang, Korea plant with the level N2.1 design. The problem is that if certain vehicles in this population are charged to near full or full capacity, the batteries may pose a risk of fire. The situation, though, is still under investigation. Now, during the summer of 2020, GM began investigating a small number of battery fire claims and confirmed that the battery-related fires appear to have occurred in 5 cases. As an interim remedy, GM dealers will reprogram the HPCM2, or Hybrid Propulsion Control Module number 2, to limit the full charge to 90%. Until this interim remedy is completed, customers are advised to enable Hilltop Reserve Mode for 17 and 18 models, and for 2019, they should select the target charge level and limit the charge to 90%. Remember, you can review specific VIN recall information on the NHTSA.gov website. Now, this brings us to our case study segment, where we have an interesting case study from Diagnostic Network titled, "The Decorated Jeep Leaves the Owner Stranded." This submission comes from Sam Brooks, who's a mobile technician in Michigan. Sam was called out to a shop to address a 2011 Jeep Wrangler that was having the WIN module, or wireless ignition node module, replaced, and they needed programming help. So after he arrived, he addressed the partially disassembled steering column, set up the WIN module, cut a couple of keys and had them programmed, and realized success with the vehicle able to start and run. After departing, a few hours later, he received a call from the shop stating that the vehicle would not start after it was reassembled. After returning to the shop the next day, he began investigating and discovered that the vehicle had a shiny bling chrome cover that went around the lock cylinder. He then confirmed that this was what was actually causing the no start condition. Again, this Diagnostic Network tech tip came from diag.net, and a link to this will be posted in the show notes. Now, this brings us to our featured guest, Joe Register from the Auto Care Association, to bring us up to speed on the recent vote on the Right to Repair initiative in Massachusetts. So let's have a listen. Today, folks, on the Torque Factor, we have Joe Register, who is the Vice President of Emerging Technologies with the Auto Care Association. Welcome to the call.
Thanks. Really appreciate it. Scott, glad to be here.
Hey, I really wanted to get you on this call because I wanted to talk a lot about the right to repair, the Massachusetts question one. But before we go into that, I just want to kind of introduce you. Joe and I have worked together, or I've been blessed to be able to work under his guidance for the last year and a half or so with an ADAS work group with some remarkable individuals. And he's really brought some interesting players into this field to try to help the service industry manage what we're going to be challenged with in the future. And earlier this year, we got together at the Southwest Research Institute, and we got a really good look at some technology that they are working on. They've got autonomous vehicles that they produce and support through the military. And I mean, it was just absolutely amazing. But at that same meeting, you had a work group there that was part of this potential solution for this, to support this right to repair secure vehicle interface. So tell me a little bit about that meeting and what they were doing.
Sure. Happy to, Scott. So the meeting was essentially a group of engineers that were attending the same information sessions that you attended when you were there, but broke out separately to talk about something we refer to as SVI. Now, that's a secure vehicle interface. You sometimes hear it referred to as secure ITS interface and so forth, but these are all informal names for a group of standards that actually reference a whole bunch of other standards that have been in place for some time. In order to try and provide safe, secure, standardized, and direct access to vehicles. And that's really in response to the concern we have as aftermarket folks about the plans that the vehicle manufacturers have been working on for a while, called the extended vehicle, which essentially pulls all the information directly from the vehicle and puts it in their cloud. And then subscribers can download whatever they decide to provision from these proprietary clouds going forward. And we just, we're really concerned because, we're kind of cut out of knowing exactly what information is going to be provided brand by brand. And there is no direct connection to the vehicle that's offered under that design. So, we recognize how important direct connections to the vehicle are, during repair and maintenance procedures. And the fact that trying to go through a cloud would be, the latency would be so great that you wouldn't be able to get dependable results.
Right. Okay. So yeah, that's a deep subject in itself. And fortunately I did, I was able to interview Gangolf Fighter, who—
Oh, terrific.
And actually he was on episode 3. So anybody listening to this, they want more research on that. We took a deep dive into that, and that was released in March of this year, we talked about the extended vehicle and how it might work for the technician. But this has all been being worked on. And he said basically they started working on this around 2012, 2013 or so. So it's been a long evolution. And, I'm pleased to know that somebody's been working on this stuff in the background. So that's pretty awesome. It's not something that was just born overnight. But more importantly, the reason I've got you on this call is because we just had an election, okay? And in the state of Massachusetts, where the original right to repair law was passed nearly a decade ago, we had another ballot initiative there, and that was question 1, and it was to support this right to repair next level, right? Next generation. So tell me just briefly a little bit about what was the meat and potatoes behind that that question.
Sure, Scott. So originally, right to repair was first started probably 2013 or so, around 2014. It really was voted as law in Massachusetts. But to make that happen, it really came down to the fact that even though we had OE dealerships joining us in the fight and others that were somewhat unexpected, and we certainly had, the favorable response to make it law, we had in the negotiation of it, there really wasn't a lot of definitive documentation, not that there is today, on the way OEs are using telematic information. And so because it would have delayed the first law by probably quite a bit to try and work telematics into that, and then the OEs dug their heels in. Now we know why, because many of them are trying to find ways to eliminate providing information through the OBD2 interface. So we left that off. We took that off the table. And so the law did not reference telematic data and said that specifically in order to be able to get the memorandum of understanding that resulted. So over the years, the OE has been working diligently to start wirelessly commuting information. As I said, the whole extended vehicle was in the mix as the way that they intended to monetize data. And so what we found is that in several cases, new vehicles being released don't even provide, under right to repair, the original law, the information that's required to repair a car. And so they've been cutting down on what comes through the OBD port. As you know, the only information that's mandated by law as far as specific detailed data is that's been defined by CARB for emissions. And the rest is either purchased through a group, the Equipment and Tool Institute, ETI, who we work very closely with Brian and Greg. They have been providing the data and brokering that on behalf of the aftermarket from the OEs. And the fact is, you couldn't even get the data that they had been providing through that relationship with ETI in these new models. There was virtually nothing coming through but OBD2 emissions data. So this really started to get us concerned. There's an increasing number of manufacturers that have taken this approach. And so we just felt it was time now to say, look, they must be getting the data. And if they're getting the data, they must be getting it wirelessly. And since they're not provisioning it through the OBD, it was time to go back and revisit the wireless factors, the telematic factors that we had taken off the table originally. And that's what we've done in this amendment.
Great. Yeah, that's that is great. It's really tough, at the service level. A lot of times, technicians are just looking at what's in front of them, right, and what they're currently working on.
Sure.
And they'll go, well, now they see a change come, and they go, well, why is it like this? Why is it so hard to get to this information? What's going on? So, we have to be thankful that there are people out there looking out for us, and making sure that we're a viable solution. In principle, it's about 70% of the repairs to the vehicle fleet out there is done in the aftermarket.
Aftermarket, yeah, absolutely right, Scott. It's not obviously broadcasted by the manufacturers themselves, but the reality is there are not enough bays to repair the cars. They barely have enough coverage for warranty. Given all the new equipment, and as you mentioned, we've been working on ADAS for a while, and that's a whole nother world of complexity.
Yes.
So, it's put a burden on the OEs from a standpoint of capacity as well. At the end of the day, they need us, and then they cut off information to us at the same time. It's perplexing, but unless we raise the visibility of this and get it in front of regulators and legislators and people who can take action, it goes unnoticed. And then, as you say, every new model here, you get less and less and less information.
Yeah, and it's pretty challenging. As I was prepping for this interview here, I was looking at some of the factors here. Well, one, this law, it was passed. It was overwhelmingly passed by 74, almost 75% approval. That is incredible.
That's right.
Yeah.
We were delighted, as you might imagine.
Yeah, and it was it got a little heated, and I don't want to go too deep into this, but boy, I saw some of the marketing campaigns from the opposition that were basically funded by the automakers, and I could not believe how outlandish of claims that they were pushing out there. Any comment on that?
I would just say it didn't paint a fair or truthful picture of the folks that, work very hard in the aftermarket to protect customers, cars, and data, and dressing up figures in cloaks and having them sneak around and so forth really wasn't fair. And to be perfectly honest with you, in much of what we've read, the public rejected that image too. I mean, many, many folks are really proud of the aftermarket shops that they work with. They've earned the trust of those customers over the years. Customers want to bring their car to those folks because they know they'll do a proper job and take care of them. And to paint them with that kind of a broad brush, it was insulting. And probably the worst thing I'll tell you is that based on the filings that we've seen, the OE spent $30 million on that campaign. And, if they'd only put that money into finding ways to provide data to the aftermarket, we think it would have been a much better investment.
Oh, not only that, I just think of the amount of education that it could have helped to fund.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're in a very complex space. The vehicle, is an important piece of a person's life, right? And we need to be able to provide the quality service and expertise, and there's a lot of dedicated folks out there in the aftermarket that do that. And the general public, I think for the most part, the reason they deal with the aftermarket is because it's more of a relationship. You're dealing with people.
Right.
Sometimes at the manufacturer level, it's like you turn into a number, right? And I've had my own vehicle at the dealer for warranty work, and I've had unpleasant experiences. But nevertheless, this is actually really good stuff. So one other piece here that I was reading about was a letter that NHTSA then published. And I was reading through this letter, and I'm looking at all the descriptions, and just with my knowledge of having that conversation with Gangolf earlier in the year, the letter was almost written like they had no knowledge of what the capabilities were, or how much research and development you guys have already done. And then I did see Bill Hanvey, he opposed that letter and reached back out to them. And it looks like there's now somewhat of a relationship there with NHTSA, and they want to ensure that these vehicles are safe, but also securely safe. That's the main thing. So tell me, what from a service technician's perspective, say that we throw the looking glass out 5 years from now, or say 8 years from now, what is this secure gateway, this relationship, or these agreements, what is that going to mean for the technician?
Wow. Well, sometimes it's challenging just to see the next 6 months with everything going on right now, Scott, but I'll do my best. I think most of the folks listening to this know that there's a constant evolution in vehicles, and they've really turned from being mechanical devices to electronic mechanical devices, and all those old analog relationships between hand movements and foot pressure and all the rest of those are all interpreted now by digital electronics, and so it's brake by wire and steer by wire and shift by wire and all the rest. The fact is that when the original CAN bus was designed, it's a serial bus. I mean, you can damn near count the bits going down the wire. I'm being facetious, but it's a very, very slow design, and no one ever expected the kind of electronics to come on the scene as we've seen when the CAN bus was designed. And so the manufacturers have actually been very active in working on upgrading those technologies and replacing the CAN bus with Ethernet. And you may have also seen articles that are becoming more commonplace about HPC or high performance computing in a vehicle. And so this constant proliferation of the modules in sensor control networks, up to 130 or 140 in some luxury vehicles, will start to diminish as they start putting in more highly complex and software-driven electronics in the car. And so from a standpoint of the technician getting the information they're going to need, you have to be able to query the bus and do that in a way where the vehicle protects its proprietary information, which is all the information in the vehicle network, but still has access to the values that come from those queries in a set of common definitions. And as you say, you've already spoken to Gangoff, and you know that he's been working on this for quite some time. The translation of that proprietary information to a standard is what one of these SVI standards, 2M184, does. And so it won't be necessary to become an expert on each of these vehicle internal systems and the modules they have and all the rest, because 2M184 will do the translation. And so this is one of the reasons ETI has been very involved with us in working through this. And in fact, Greg has been involved with much of this in ISO and SAE before I even was involved myself in this. And so ETI is going to help bridge that old world that we've been in, where, you know, information was coming through the OBD, to helping manufacturers with the 2M184 translation. And again, it's, you know, it's essentially they're the experts on the data. They're the ones that have been working with this for quite some time. And they're the ones that will help the scan tool manufacturers adapt. And it will take some education, and it will take some negotiation and all the rest to be able for scan tools to adapt. But I'm confident that they've risen to the challenges in the past, and they'll be able to do that again. So from a technician's eyes, you know, they will have more evolved tools. They will talk more directly to the internal vehicle systems. They'll have greater capacity to get data, but they won't have to change their modus operandi, if you want, between brands of vehicles. And so we're trying to increase the diagnostic, or reduce the diagnostic time and increase the information. Because of all the electronics in these vehicles, it's going to become a bigger and bigger and bigger part of repair and maintenance. So my long-term vision is it's going to be more complex, but we have been working on ways to reduce the complexity during the actual repair process.
Yeah, I like that. My vision is I see some things coming at us that I think that some of us have actually wished that we had many years ago. It's especially when cars have like a strange anomaly that occurs only certain amount of time, and a car comes in and the technician can't find anything wrong. And it would be so nice to be able to go back and look at history. And, you know, we do have some minimum function. I will call it minimum function because the way OBD was architected way back in the 90s, a lot of limitations. They just were not looking way out in the future, and we just didn't know, right? And, you know, you get a freeze frame data, but sometimes that freeze frame data, it's a timestamp of data, but some of those, the PIDs are, they're collected at different times. And so you may not even be able to see the issue. So I can definitely see, yes, there will be an evolution of tools. Of course, it'll be more PC based. The language or the data will be more normalized, going through some standards. Right. Being able to, again, look at some historic data and help the customer actually work work the way we should be working, right? When your computer today has a problem, you know, and it crashes or whatever, it usually produces a nice little bug report and it says, hey, you want to submit this? And you go, yeah, I'll submit it, and hopefully it'll help somebody figure it out. Same thing I see happening in the vehicle. But yeah, you talked about the data, the amount of data being produced on these automobiles. And because we've got video, a lot more video on the perception systems that are tying up buses. And now they're bringing in extra buses. And now we've got buses that are secure buses or private buses. And this data is crucial, not only for the vehicle operation, but also for the manufacturer to learn about what's happening with that car and how to make it better. We can't cut the aftermarket out of the information loop.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, won't do anybody any good. So, tell me, you know, there has been a lot of work taking place, and it continues. And going back to that group that I was fortunate to observe some activity there in San Antonio while at Southwest Research. The guys that were working, the guys and gals that were working on the secure vehicle interface. I'm listening to these guys talk, and it was just, my head was pounding. I think Chris Chesney was in the room with me too, and we're both going, "Oh my God, what are these guys talking about?" So, can you give me just a kind of a high level look at where are these folks from? What organizations do they work with, and what's their expertise?
Sure. First thing I'm going to do is give Southwest a plug for welcoming the aftermarket into their facility and giving us a tour. And you know from firsthand experience how wonderful, how generous, and how open those folks are. So a shout out to those guys. They're
absolutely
incredible.
Yeah.
I'm blessed, to be perfectly candid, Scott. We have 10, 11 of the recognized global experts from everything from CAN bus technologies to security, to communications, working with us on this project. AutoCare's role really has been sponsoring this work when there was really little to no alternative for these experts to do their work. And so we stepped into the breach when their funding had dried up. We won't get into why the funding dried up, but I think you can probably draw your own conclusions. So AutoCare stepped into the breach and sponsored the work that you witnessed, one of the meetings that you witnessed. And these experts many of them are recognized in all standards organizations, IEEE, which is the Electronic Engineers Group, SAE, used to stand for Society of Automotive Engineers, but I guess now it doesn't stand for anything. Another very common standards body, and ISO, but also CEN and DIN and a whole bunch of others. They've been writing standards for quite some time. And as you know, when you talk to Gangolf, he himself has authored probably over 100 different standards over the years. And many of those related directly to communication protocols within the vehicle and so forth. When we said, look, this all seems like a great idea, and it was being rejected by SAE and rejected by part of ISO that deals with the internal vehicles, we said this isn't right. And if we're going to have a way to be able to point to a solution that makes sense and that is acceptable to everyone involved, it should be based on standards. And the vehicle manufacturers use standards every day in all their design work. So this would be a normal progression for them to move to new standards around securing information going in and out of the vehicle. And so we started working with a handful, and it expanded. And the reality is many of these engineers have and some continue to work with the OEs themselves in solutions. So the OEs know them, and they recognize their expertise and are like as I say, adopting standards written by them in other areas. So it shouldn't really be a stretch for them to accept the same leadership through standards that they already rely on in their vehicle design. And these guys are just unbelievable. It's humbling to lead a group with this kind of expertise, and I'm really blessed to have them all with me.
Yeah, I will definitely second the fact that these guys, I mean, I was in this meeting and they were working through a couple of challenges, and they were just basically, you know, they're running on a whiteboard, they were throwing spaghetti up against the wall, seeing what stuck. Then they would challenge each other, and I'm just watching this unfold, and I'm going, oh my God, I am so lucky to be witnessing what I'm seeing right now, because, you know, I'm a technician, right? That's where I came into the industry. That's sure. where I've evolved, and it's just absolutely wonderful. And I was blessed, and to really thank Southwest Research for opening up their gates for us to come in and host us. They gave us a tour of some of their technology. We got to go on a test track and drive a fully, you know, autonomous vehicle that they had, two different vehicles. They had a big Humvee military setup, and they had a Ford Fusion, I think, setup, and it was absolutely amazing. So, again, Joe, I really appreciate you coming on and sharing your knowledge and expertise with me, so that I can bring that forward to the industry folks that I'm serving. So thank you again, and I want to keep you in close contact, because I want to see how this thing progresses, and if we learn some new stuff coming down the road, this is a great medium for us to communicate the knowledge and information outbound, so that folks understand what's happening behind the scenes and what to expect in the future.
Well, thanks, Scott. It's my pleasure. Absolutely, would love to be on again with you, and maybe we can even bring an expert or two along the next time, and talk about some of the more detailed stuff, and especially as this whole right to repair amendment plays out, kind of just give you a glimpse as to how that might be also affecting the future.
Yeah, that would be
happy
great.
To do that.
That would be great. So thanks again, Joe. Have a great day.
That brings us to the Industry Events Roundup. Leading automotive industry organizations from across the U.S. have joined together and created the new training event, PAVE, P-A-V-E, which stands for Professional Automotive Virtual Education, which promises to be the ultimate virtual training event for automotive professionals. The PAVE training event is powered by both CarQuest Technical Institute and Worldpac Training Institute. The virtual training will take place over 3 days, beginning Friday, January 8th, and will run through Sunday, January 10th. Shops will enjoy the best and top trainers in the industry, teaching more than 30 live training sessions. P10 MotorAge, ABRN, and VehicleServicePros.com will be presenting the Vehicle Repair Virtual Training Summit starting Wednesday, January 20th, 2021, offering on-demand access to 40-plus training courses for 45 days at one low price. Visit VehicleServicePros.com/Virtual Training Summit to register today. The Vision High Tech Training and Expo has announced its 2021 event will transition from an in-person event to a virtual event. The 6-day training event will span across 2 weeks, consuming 3 days each week. The event will start on Tuesday, March 2nd, and will conclude on Thursday, March 11th. Visit visionkc.com for more information.
Hello, Newman.
And this bit of feedback came from Matthew Potter in Nova Scotia. Matthew writes, "Hi. Just wanted to reach out and say thank you for using my case study in episode 7. Love your podcast content, interviews, and topics. I haven't found another one like it. Keep up the great work. Matt." Well, thank you, Matt. We appreciate your feedback. And anyone else listening out there, we'd love to get yours as well. Email podcasts@vehicleservicepros.com. Now that brings us to the end of the show, and we hope we are able to bring you some quality content. And we thank you for joining us. And we're looking for your feedback. So if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions on future topics and/or featured guests, please drop them in our mailbag.